All right, today's show, September 30th, 2009. First article is by Brad Budowski, writing in smirkingchimp.com. He calls it, "Does Obama Have a Secret Deal with Insurance Companies?" Progressives throughout the nation should rally in full force in favor of the public option, and progressives in Congress should say they will not support a bill without it. The public option still lives because it would save $50 billion, according to the Congressional Budget Office, with a president in Congress that claim they want to save money. The public option still lives because it's the only check and balance against insurance company abuses. Senator Max Baucus of Montana, the Democratic chair of the Financial Committee, which is the only committee of the five that are reporting a health bill whose measure does not include the public option, says he is for public option while he votes against the public option. But let's look back at the history. It was in June when Senator Kent Conrad of North Dakota, another Finance Committee Democrat who says he is for the public option while he votes against it, was approached by Senator Baucus to find an alternative to the public option that both Baucus and Conrad could claim they support. Remember, in June, the public option was supported by a large number of voters, as it is now. Why did Baucus and Conrad seek an alternative to the public option in June, when the public option they both claimed to support appeared very strong? It's time for progressives, consumers, workers, populists, and anyone who supports affordable health care to ask, was the fix in from the beginning through a secret deal between the White House and insurance companies to kill the public option? I don't know. But I do know that a secret deal with Big Pharma was made in similar fashion. Sure, the fact of the pharma deal was known, but many details remain secret today. I do know the president has given the weakest support imaginable to the public option, and time and again has announced his willingness to surrender, as I wrote on this 6 months ago. I do know that to this day the White House is keeping secret the logs of meetings from January through September when deals were made from the banking bailout to the health care bill. I strongly suspect the reason involves meetings about deals including pharma and insurers. Was the fix in against the public option? I don't know. But I do know this. If enough members of the House and Senate refuse to support a bill without a public option, the public option can still prevail. I also know this. A majority of the American people support the public option. I know this. Over 75% of respondents in the Washington Post ABC poll support a public option for those who cannot get private policies. What would it say about a Democratic Senate that many of us worked hard and for years to win 60 seats if it lacks even the minimum courage to stand up with more than 75% of the American nation, either because it fears the 25% or it craves the money the industry doles out to Democrats as well as Republicans? I know this. The three House committees that reported a health care bill all included the public option. I know this. The Senate Health Committee reported a bill that also included the public option. I know this. The Congressional Budget Office says the Rockefeller public option proposal would cut the cost of the bill by $50 billion, and anyone who opposes it makes a mockery of their alleged interest in protecting taxpayers and reducing wasteful spending. I know this. There's no serious analyst of health care who believes that insurance co-ops are even a minimum check and balance against insurance abuses, and even the Congressional Budget Office says co-ops will have virtually zero impact lowering the cost of the bill. I know this. Some of the Democrats who are opposed to the public option, or who pretend to support it within minutes of their voting against it, are huge recipients of campaign money from insurance companies. I know this. The insurance industry has been proven again and again to have engaged in abuses, and yet the insurance industry is granted an exemption from antitrust laws that should be repealed and allows them to commit price-fixing collusion, market allocation, and other wrongs that would be illegal in virtually every industry under antitrust laws. I know this. Private insurers don't give a rat's behind about the poor, the jobless, the hungry, the hurting, and will charge them high premiums they cannot afford. So a Congress that does not include a public option will create huge subsidies, not for the poor, but for insurers who charge outrageous premiums the poor cannot afford. And I know this. The president, who reads a book about Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days, who read a book about Franklin Roosevelt's first 100 days, has not even begun to wage a true fight for the most important provision of a health care bill, and has hinted, winked, nodded again and again that he would gladly surrender on this vital issue, which raises the legitimate question, is there a secret deal with insurers for a formal surrender that leaves a bill with gigantic windfall profits for insurers, subsidized with taxpayer money, to be ratified by a Democratic president and Democratic Congress? I don't know whether there is such a deal, but I do know that this question should now be asked, and above all, I do know this. A majority of the American people, a majority of the Senate, a majority of the House, and the President, with great eloquence, all support the public option. If progressives wage the fight that should be fought, the public option should, can, and will be won. Brent Budowski, published by Smirking Chimp. Another article by the same author, also in Smirking Chimp. He calls it Optional Health Deal. If Congress passes a health care bill without the public option, it should be called the Insurance Industry Windfall Profit Act, and Congress should repeal the antitrust exemption for the insurance industry. In fact, the antitrust exemption should be repealed regardless of what happens with a health care bill. Imagine passing a law that defines price fixing, collusion, and market allocation as legal and promoted by government policy. Guess what? That's the law today, because the industry is exempt from antitrust law. The president eloquently describes the abuses under the current system. Members of the House and Senate speak eloquently about constituents who suffer abuse. Yet the president and Congress allow the continuation of policies that legalize what for other industries is illegal. The current oligopolistic structure of the industry makes repeal of the antitrust exemption even more compelling. In state after state, the insurance business is dominated by one or two companies. The situation that antitrust laws are designed to prevent is exactly the situation that exists today in market after market throughout the nation. If the President and Congress want to stand up for those suffering abuse, they should stand against the practice that promotes these abuses. To continue the exemption is a license for price fixing, collusion, and market allocation to continue along with the abuses they promote. If opponents of the public option are confident their policies will protect consumers, they have nothing to fear by repealing the antitrust exemption. If there are no violations of the law, there will be no successful antitrust cases brought. While it remains unclear what the president's true position on the public option is, what he says is true. It is the public option that creates the real choice and the true check and balance against private industry abuses. If Congress merely forces consumers to buy policies from private insurers and then imposes punishment against consumers who don't buy private market products, the result will be the maximum profits to insurers and minimum protection for consumers. Insurance co-ops are valuable and should be supported, but there's no evidence that co-ops would offer the kind of large-size competition that a public option would provide. The evidence over many years is exactly the opposite. If you believe co-ops are a legitimate alternative to the public option to provide a check and balance against industry abuse, I've got some toxic assets to sell you. In a recent poll, more than 75% of respondents expressed support for a public option for those who cannot get private insurance. Surely, a Democratic president and Democratic Congress can summon the policy sense and political courage to stand with three-fourths of the nation, and surely there are one or two Republicans who can support a bill that is less enlightened than the program proposed by President Richard Nixon. So here's the deal. The insurance industry should accept a public option, and in return, Congress can allow the antitrust exemption to continue. If not, the exemptions should be ended. That, or some future president and Congress, will have to clean up the mess, and voters will be unhappy campers as the abuses continue. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Caller, you're live on KVMR. Hello. Well, they were very patiently let the phone ring the whole time I was reading that article, and then they weren't there. Who knows? The next article. It's by John Faulkner, writing in Smirking Chimp. It's called Revolution, or the Realization of Orwell's Vision. Corporations, as they endlessly scheme for complete control over the planet's finite resources, will order the planet's social order into whatever structure is necessary to ensure corporate dominance over the individual. Orwell recognized the corporate entity's driven ambition to abolish representative government in favor of corporate oligarchy. For anyone who isn't blind, it's easy to recognize that representative democracy in the U.S. has been cast aside. The government and the politicians who pretend to represent ordinary Americans are a wholly owned and operated subsidy of the corporate state. At this point, only revolution will reestablish the democratic state. But as is true in all revolution, the final disposition rarely ever resembles the original conception of newness. Corporate dominance over humanity and the finite resources of the planet are simply another religion expressed in the short term. The corporation is served in direct proportion to the extent an individual is, in immediacy, willing to surrender identity in the interests of the corporate good. Thus, it is that corporate profit and growth are determined through maximum efficiency at the cost of individual identity. The corporate God entity rewards by the same criteria that religious orthodoxy promises heaven. Heaven is the ultimate retirement community, without sickness, pain, sorrow, or need. The corporation mirrors the same precept, with the only exception being one promises its adherents immediate gratification in terms of a paycheck, health benefits, vacations, and retirement, while the other gives its reward or punishment only after death. A system of increasingly diminished reward is the natural progression of the corporate as it seeks to maximize profit and control over its human elements. Employee benefits, as the corporation strengthens, are easily withdrawn after its employees are indebted to the company's store. The store is, of course, the mortgage industry, the banks that loan to those willing to conform, the healthcare industry, and the various other corporate entities that promise futures to those who toe the line. The corporate state is a many-headed hydra that seeks to give nothing and take everything. The corporate monster has been successful in the U.S., but the rest of the world sees that it has allowed its greed and ambition to overtake it. U.S. estimation has fallen prodigiously amongst the world community as it recognizes there will be no political solutions reigning in the unregulated and reckless corporate state. The right-wing U.S. Supreme Court is now considering arguments that would reverse the restriction on corporations during elections and also reverse a century of law that forbid any corporation from contributing to political campaigns. The venue under which these questions have come before the court are corporate personhood, that corporations are immortal and have as their sole purpose the accumulation of ever more material does not enter into the consideration of the Roberts Court. Neither does the fact that the word corporation does not appear anywhere in the U.S. Constitution. Corporations have absolutely no loyalty to anyone or anything with the exception of their shareholders. Americans, their eyes riveted on Beck, Limbaugh, et al., take not so much as a passing interest in such corporate control of their most revered institutions of government. Human destiny must be determined by its own active involvement. The extent to which humanity is willing to surrender its identity to an inhuman entity whose single purpose is in controlling completely the humans and the finite material resources of the planet is to the same extent to which humanity will influence its ultimate destination. All religious orthodoxy recognizes the earthbound authority of one ruling authority or another. Thus the common thread, render unto Caesar the things which are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God. This binds together orthodox religion with a secular. That separation was an article of the Constitution before Bush Jr. appointment by a court so corrupt it was necessary for its highly partisan justices to invoke new law to install an immoral half-wit to the presidency. The corporate state, in the interests of cheaper labor, has exported the U.S. manufacturing base out of the country. American workers are no longer able to produce the products the rest of the world recognizes as valuable. The collapse of the housing industry will be shortly followed by the collapse of the healthcare industry. The U.S. Congress, a corporate entity by any definition, intends doing nothing whatsoever towards controlling the ever-spiraling costs of corporate health care. The appointment of Bush Jr. to the presidency vastly escalated the diminishment of the U.S. as a responsible member of the world community. Today, the government, fronting for the corporate state, must borrow ever-increasing sums from foreign lenders as the government's money machines run 24/7 printing dollars, all in a futile effort to sustain an unsustainable economy. Bush Jr.'s wars were necessary, as Obama's continuation of them are. They have struck another blow at the underpinning of the U.S. economy. The wars are needed to keep the corporate defense departments working while the U.S. dollar loses its status as the world's fiat currency. Even Zimbabwe, that tiny South African nation, has replaced the dollar with a South African rand. Russia, China, India, and many other nations have taken steps to distance themselves from the U.S. dollar and are increasingly refusing to acknowledge it as the world's reserve currency. Back at the loony bin, media clowns distort the meaning of the Constitution and lie with complete impunity for the express purpose of exciting the crowd. It is not possible to argue with Beck, Limbaugh, O'Reilly, or their devoted audiences. Their language is couched in the simple cadences of fear and resentment. No reason, thoughtful appeal can hope to penetrate the crowd's mind. That would only see such appeal as a tedious trial upon its extremely limited attention. The crowd desires, needs, the copious outpouring of extremity in the form of hate, slander, and abuse. They need a tangible victim for their pain, and liberals serve admirably in that capacity. Their intransigent ignorance permits them to believe that a liberal media dominates. This is corporate crowd control at its best. It not only isolates the corporate detractors, but it serves a further purpose, the erosion of language as a communication tool that has the power to sway and influence with logical and thoughtful debate. Newt Gingrich introduced a studied incivility to Congress during his climb to power. He developed a list of code words with which to slander his opponent. Betray, corrupt, shame, sick, steal, liar, thief, and traitor were a few such words that Gingrich urged his Republican colleagues to surreptitiously use against Democrats. Ironically, these words apply very specifically to Newt himself when he was charged, as House Speaker, of no less than 84 ethics violations. Any tyrant knows that an attack against a nation's language must be one of the first steps to absolute control. The president is a man who wants to please the powerful, to the extent he will abandon his base to do so. As the corporations continue consolidating power, the common men and women will find themselves increasingly helpless. They can't fight back because they have little money, and forcing change into the corporate structure is a very expensive proposition. Lacking the dollars is exacerbated by the millions of Americans who consider any government program that benefits Americans as socialist, even though it was socialism that saved the capitalist banks from themselves. The corporations, with their network media, make certain that a large number of Americans are kept believing such nonsense. The polarization of the two major U.S. political parties has resulted, as it was meant to, in an angry and resentful South and Midwest. Progressives in the Northeast and Far West futilely attempt to bring some kind of sanity to a nation gone mad. For their efforts, they're rewarded with cries of derision and hate by the conservatives. The end result, if nothing changes, will be the violent overthrow of government or the realization of Orwell's dystopian vision. The corporate monsters, who are directly responsible for destroying so much that Americans once held dear, will go undetected and unpunished. In fact, they will very likely continue stealing America's minerals, forest products, and other natural resources. Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh, Bill O'Reilly, and the many other hate radio and television loonies have done their work well. Americans are polarized into two camps, and the corporate monster is gleeful over its success. Giving personhood to the corporate entity was the nation's undoing. It was only a matter of time until Congress was bought and Americans lost their representative government. When the banks helped themselves to multiple trillions of the public's money, all argument that government is still representative became superfluous, even for those who still cling to the illusion that they were living in a representative democracy. That was Dave Lindorf. Oh, sorry. John Faulkner, Smirking Chimp. Revolution or the Realization of Orwell's Vision. By the way, just an aside, there's a very interesting story behind how the Supreme Court decided that corporations are persons. I can't give it to you in detail. I can more or less paraphrase, but it would be worth your looking up on Google. Because evidently there was a secretary that was recording the machinations of the court, and he inserted his own words in it, which changed the meaning of the court decision, and that's how we ended up with a situation where corporations are considered persons. There was some sleight of hand going on there. And that happened, I believe, around the turn of the century. Something worth looking up. If somebody comes up with a concise article on that, please send it to me and I'll read it on air. The time, 12:30 in the p.m. The place, Nevada City, California. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show, Rabble Rousing. Next article by Dave Lindorf, Smirking Chimp. They call this season fall for a reason. So now it turns out that the whole Troubled Assets Relief Program, or TARP, was a flop, or more likely a scam. Remember Bush Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson telling us last September that credit markets had locked up, and then after half of the $750 billion that he extorted out of Congress was handed out to Wall Street firms, new President Barack Obama justifying the spending of the second half of the money because we needed to get the banks lending again? Okay, so we've got a caller again. Let's try and see. Caller, you're live on the air. Caller, you're live on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, you're live on the air.
Oh, yeah, that Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad was a precedent for the mortal soul of the corporation have a soul.
Okay.
And it was the secretary, it was the headlines of the paragraphs of the judge's actual words.
Okay.
He switched the headlines. He lied. You know how the judge said no. A corporation cannot have considered as a soul.
Okay.
And the secretary summation this lied, misled, misdirected.
Uh-huh.
Knowing that in subsequent case law that goes down where there's got to be thousands of case law built on this, so
right.
It's really complicated. But law clerks would just read the headline.
Oh, okay.
And that's how it went down. And if anybody tripped into the lie, they kept quiet. And see how the liar and the lie lives through cowardice and laziness? That's it.
Fantastic.
So if we just heal ourselves, if we don't get sick and use alternative medicine, well, you know, suppose they gave a war and nobody came.
Okay.
And that's a challenge to us. I mean, and I better get off the phone.
Okay. If you have documentation for that little history lesson you just gave us, would you please send it to me?
Gee, I don't, but I do remember it's the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad. It was a matter of Sarah Winchester didn't want the SP coming down her property line.
Look, I've got to move on. Would you mind just writing me a brief letter telling me that and sending it to me? Just email?
Santa Clara. Well, I I tried to email you, and I got to join. I can't email now. My Yahoo's busted. But Santa Clara County versus SP Railroad, Southern Pacific Railroad.
Versus Southern Pacific Railroad.
Yeah, that's the case.
Santa Clara County.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Welcome back.
All right, you have a great day. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hey, Chamba. I'll go ahead and post a link to a Wikipedia article about this controversy. There's a lot of good links and a lot of good information there.
Terrific. So you'll send it to me at chamba@kvmr.org?
When we post your archive, this is John.
Oh.
We'll go ahead and I'll add that link. I've got a link of it here.
Terrific. Thank you.
Okay.
That was John Button, the KVMR webmaster. That supports me in many ways, and that's just one of them. Thanks very much.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye. Okay, I'll get back to the article I was reading for a minute, but we have a bulletin here. Cal Fire is currently fighting a vegetation fire in the Fowler area of Lincoln. The fire is on Hungry Hollow Road near Hard Scrabble Road. It's at 5 to 6 acres when this report came in, with structures threatened, although no evacuations were planned at that time. CAL FIRE says numerous ground and air equipment is actively fighting the fire, including 8 engines and 2 air tankers. So there you have it. That was a fire in the Fowler area of Lincoln, Hungry Hollow Road near Harst Scrabble Road. And at the time of that report, it was 5 to 6 acres. Okay, back to the article I was reading. Okay, new President Barack Obama justifying the spending of the second half of that $750 billion because we needed, quote, to get the banks lending again. Well, now Neil Barofsky, the special investigator general for TARP, is telling us that all that money and another more than $2 trillion in loans accomplished nothing. In an interview with Lagan Siebert, published in Huffington Post, Barofsky says, quote, we were told by Treasury that the purpose of the TARP fund was to increase lending, but we haven't increased lending. Close quote. Well, yeah, that's true. Just ask any ordinary working stiff. My little bank, the Hartleysville National Bank here in eastern Pennsylvania, far from expanding lending, has been shutting down customer credit lines. As a bank manager told me, they were reviewing all our equity lines. In light of declining property values, and actually property values in our area north of Philadelphia have remained pretty stable. In general, banks across the country have been canceling credit lines, closing credit card accounts on customers deemed risky, including small businesses, and making it very hard to get a new mortgage. They've also been raising all kinds of fees, ripping customers off in other ways, but that's another story. And that goes for the biggest bank that got billions of dollars in taxpayer bailout funds. Barofsky has been trying doggedly to find out what happened to all the money of ours that we shoveled out to the banks. And as he reports, he's been working not just without any help from the Treasury Department, but actually against the active resistance of Treasury, which he accuses of having tried to dissuade him from even looking into it. My biggest surprise, he says, is when we announced an audit of TARP, Treasury went out of their way to say it would be a big waste of time. He says Treasury officials, including Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, claimed that it would be impossible to find out where the money went, on the argument that money is fungible, that is to say, all money is the same. Of course, this is a cynical and ridiculous assertion. If it were true, there would be no job for auditors, since all auditors do is look to find out where money went. Imagine telling an IRS auditor that it's a waste of time auditing your books, because money is fungible. In any event, Barofsky has gone about his work with or without the backing of the Obama Treasury Department, and what he found is that instead of lending out the money that they were being provided by the taxpayers, the banks have been acquiring other institutions, sitting on it, paying down credit lines, and of course paying out obscene bonuses to its executives. The one thing the banks are not doing is lending. But then, as I wrote last February, it was silly to think that by shoveling money into banks during a record recession, the bank would then lend it out. First of all, there was the awkward reality that good companies were and still are not looking to borrow money. Rather, they're trying to pay down debt and get their balance sheets on more solid ground to survive a period of lower declining sales and earnings. The only companies that would be trying to borrow right now would be the ones that were on the rocks and wanted money just to stay afloat. And what banker would lend to them? And second, if the banks could make more money by investing their new cash instead of making risky loans with it, why would they loan? So most of them just used the money to invest in treasury bonds. The long and the short of it is that we've been taken for a very big and costly ride by banks that created a huge crisis and then got the government to bail them out of it with our money and by two administrations, one Republican and now one Democratic, that have been submissive and willing servants of the big banks. The big surprise to me has been Paul Volcker, who I mistakenly took to be an over-the-hill relic and Wall Street patsy. The former Carter and Reagan-era Federal Reserve Board chairman, currently chair of President Obama's economic advisory panel, is publicly warning that the president's bank policies are preserving a system of giant banks that are, quote, too big to fail, and are risking further, even larger bailouts. Barofsky agrees, saying that since the bailout under Obama's bank policies, big banks already deemed too big to fail, had become even bigger. And he concludes, quote, "We may be in a far more dangerous place today than we were a year ago for having told certain financial companies that we will not let them fail." Close quote. Little wonder that the smart money that would be the insiders in corporate boardrooms and executive suites is reportedly selling shares as fast as they can be sold, with the experts reporting that insider sales of company stocks are running 31-to-1 on the sell side. The explanation: with layoffs still running at over 500,000 a month and nobody hiring, these executives don't see anything in the year ahead or even longer that is likely to put the economy on a renewed growth path. Putting these bits of news together doesn't paint a pretty picture. We've got an economy that appears headed for, at best, a long period of stagnation, and more likely for a second downturn once the effects of last March's stimulus package wears off. We've got a financial system that has been propped up artificially, its balance sheet soggy with underwater mortgages and worthless derivatives, and its executives holding assurances that they can count on the government bailing them out no matter what stupid or self-serving decisions they make. We've got an economy that is 70% based upon consumer spending, in which one of five people is unemployed or involuntarily underemployed. We've got a nation that hardly makes anything, at the same time that its currency is sinking like a stone, making imports increasingly expensive. And we have a stock market that has been inflated into a giant bubble just waiting to pop. October should be an interesting month this year. That was Dave Lindorf writing in SmirkingChimp.com. Oh boy, lots of articles, not much time. The G20 announces the New World Order by Michael Collins. Bailoutpeople.org, republished in Smirking Chimp. Pittsburgh. A new world order is emerging at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh with a decision by the group to become the premier coordinating body on economic issues. The world's most exclusive public club, the G20, met last week in Pittsburgh for the opportunity to take stock of the progress made and discuss further actions to assure sound recovery from the global economic and financial crises. The G20 consists of finance ministers and senior banking officials from the world's 20 largest economies. Federal Reserve Board Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner were there for the United States. But the real actions comes from the gathering's function as an informal summit for attending heads of state. The Pittsburgh summit focused on changing the regulations governing the world's financial institutions and processes. In addition to rewriting the rule book, the New World Order announced that the G20 is now the premier coordinating body on economic issues, which will benefit the wealthiest interests of each member in the country. But it was more than just about making the banks behave. In cooperation with U.S. and foreign law enforcement agencies, Pittsburgh's police and unidentified law enforcement agents unveiled some new programs for citizens. These had nothing to do with much-needed jobs and health care, which were barely mentioned at the meeting. Rather, the G20 premiered the sonic cannon, a device designed to cause serious pain from ultra-shrill sonic waves beamed at those exercising their rights of freedom of speech and assembly. Law enforcement used the more traditional techniques like the citizen grab and snatch. This maneuver has four rapid stages. Unidentified law enforcement officials show up in an unmarked car, grab a random citizen, shove him into a car against his will, and drive off, all without a word of explanation. The snatch and grab, and this article included a video, the sonic cannon, they also included a video, was deployed and emitted those exact words. This is from Pittsburgh Police Chief. "This is an unlawful assembly. I order all those assembled to immediately disperse. You must leave the immediate vicinity. If you remain in this immediate vicinity, you will be in violation of the Pennsylvania Crimes Code, no matter what your purpose is." Close quote. There were no criticisms of police actions from the G20 leaders, many of whom preside over nominally democratic states. That's probably because there were no questions from the press. The Power Salon has been functioning since 1975, when a smaller, even more exclusive group met at the request of then-President of France, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing. The G8 leaders convened to manage the economic and social impact from rapidly rising oil prices. 1 year later, prices dipped briefly, then nearly tripled after the Iranian Revolution. Over the years, the world's financial leaders met periodically, building their franchise, until the Pittsburgh summit, at which the new magic number of 20 nations was announced, the G20. At an April G20 meeting, this is getting too lengthy. Let me try and fast forward through this. The people who brought the world to this state of decline and struggle are still in charge. They're fixing the very problems they created. What's their solution? Change the way banks are regulated. The U.S. can no longer finance its military presence overseas without major debt. Foreign wars are simply not affordable. The banking system is in critical condition, unable to recover except on a superficial level. The neglect of domestic concerns in the United States and the ongoing drain of wealth from the middle working and lower classes have virtually eliminated taxation and the Treasury as a viable source of real funds. Undeterred, the United States government has begun yet another war it cannot afford in Afghanistan, and they're not even mentioning the war that we're starting in Pakistan, before even beginning to end the occupation of Iraq. At the same time, the government has issued trillions of dollars in cash and credit for a banking sector, while many banks are technically broke. Again, I'm going to try and skip through this. Here's what they're really saying. It's time to fix a new set of rules that allows the game to continue in some form that will protect accumulated wealth and maintain those in power. While the leaders and their financial ministers work out the latest scheme to produce a balance sheet that won't generate laughter and derision, they must ponder the finite limitations of their economies. Unlike the exuberance of the 1950s, with the assumption of limitless energy in the form of oil, there is an awareness that the fuel underlying the entire scheme is increasingly more difficult and expensive to extract. Concerns about diminishing returns from exploration and extraction are mixed with notions that there may be an end to the affordability of oil, given the voracious appetites of two of the G2's new members, China and India. But the leaders can sit and repose at their elegantly catered conference dinners, with a comfort that although they may not be the managers of a perpetual scheme of growth for their incredibly wealthy patrons, they will certainly transition to the role managing the chaos caused by their efforts. Their street-level operatives unveil new technologies and techniques at each G20 conference to discourage those who seek to disagree by public assembly and free speech. When the G20 is in town, basic political rights, here and overseas, are suspended. It's time for the beatdown. the heavy-handed, technically brutish suppression of public protests, or a form of instructive theater that engenders a feeling of helplessness for many who might otherwise be motivated to resist. This in turn perpetuates order and protection for the G20's ongoing acts of greed and incompetence inflicted upon the vast majority of citizens in the nations they represent. If they quiet the voice of the people long enough, the leaders may even begin to think that the voices never existed in the first place. They can ignore what they've forgotten, the will of those that they govern. Okay, let's talk about what went on in Pittsburgh. It's called, the article's called RoboCops Come to Pittsburgh and Bring the Latest Weaponry with Them. It's by Mike Ferner, Smirking Chimp. No longer the stuff of disturbing futuristic fantasies. An arsenal of crowd control munitions, including one that reportedly made its debut in the U.S., was deployed with a massive, overpowering police presence in Pittsburgh during last week's G20 protests. Nearly 200 arrests were made, and civil liberty groups charged that many thousands of police, most transported on Port Authority buses displaying "Pittsburgh welcomes the world," from as far away as Arizona and Florida, with overreacting, and they had plenty of weaponry with which to do it. Beanbags fired from shotguns, CS, tear gas, oloraisin capsicum spray, which is pepper spray, flashbang grenades, batons, and according to local news reports, for the first time on the streets of America, the long-range acoustic device, or LRAD. Mounted in the turret of an armored personnel carrier, I saw the LRAD in action twice in the area of 25th Penn and Liberty Streets. Blasting a shrill, piercing noise like a high-pitched police siren on steroids, it quickly swept streets and sidewalks of pedestrians, merchants, and journalists and drove residents into their homes. But in neither case were any demonstrators present. The armored personnel carrier, oversized and sinister for a city street, together with lines of police in full riot gear looking like darkly threatening Michelin men, made for a scene out of a movie you didn't want to be in. As intimidating as this massive show of armed force and technology was, the good burghers of Pittsburgh and their fellow citizens in the land of the brave and home of the free ain't seen nothing yet. Tear gas and pepper spray are nothing to sniff at, and indeed have proved fatal a surprising number of times. But they've now become the old standby compared to the list below that's already at or coming soon to a police station or National Guard headquarters near you. Proving that what goes around comes around, some of the new property protection devices were developed by a network of federally funded university-based research institutes, like one in Pittsburgh itself, Penn State's Institute for Non-Lethal Defense Technologies, Raytheon Corporation's Active Denial System, designed for crowd control in combat zones, uses an energy beam to induce an intolerable heating sensation, like a hotter iron placed on the skin. It is effective beyond the range of small arms, in excess of 400 meters. Company officials have been advised that they could expand the market by selling a smaller, tripod-mounted version for police forces. Then there's the M5 modular crowd control munition, with a range of 30 meters. It's similar in operation to a Claymore mine, but it delivers a strong, non-penetrating blow to the body with multiple submunitions, 600 rubber balls. Then there's the long-range acoustic device, or the Scream. It's a powerful megaphone the size of a satellite dish that can emit sound 50 times greater than the human threshold for pain at close range, causing permanent hearing damage. The LA Times wrote U.S. Marines in Iraq used it in 2004. It can deliver recorded warnings in Arabic and on command emit a piercing tone. For most people, even if they plug their ears, the device will produce the equivalent of an instant migraine. And this was spoken by the chairman of American Technological Corporation, the San Diego firm that produces the weapon. Quote, "It will knock some people on their knees." Close quote. CBS News reported in 2005 that the Israeli army first used the device in the field to break up a protest against Israel's separation wall. Protesters covered their ears and grabbed their heads, overcome by dizziness and nausea, after the vehicle-mounted device began sending out bursts of audible, not loud, sound at intervals of about 10 seconds. A military official said the device emits a special frequency that targets the inner ear. Then we have, in non-lethal technologies, an overview. Two authors describe a lengthy catalog of new weaponry, including the directed stick radiator, a handheld system based on the same technology as the screen. It fires high-intensity sonic bullets or pulses of sound. Such a weapon could, when fully developed, have the capacity to knock people off their feet. Jesus. There's a whole list of devices that they're... non-lethal technology that they're developing. Let me get to the take-home lesson of this, if there is one. In Pittsburgh last week, an enormous, expensive show of police and weaponry intended for security, quote security, of the G20 delegates simultaneously shut workers out of downtown jobs for 2 days, forcing gasping students and residents back into their dormitories and homes, and turn journalists' press passes into quaint, obsolete reminders of a bygone time. Most significant of all, however, was what Witold Walczak, legal director of the Pennsylvania ACLU, told the Associated Press. It's not just intimidation. It's disruption, and in some cases, outright prevention of peaceful protesters being able to get their message out. So, that's what... those guys have been developing. Remember the protests in Seattle, a World Trade Organization protest. Each time you have a protest, these guys go back into their labs and say, okay, how can we defeat the protesters? How can we stifle protest? And Pittsburgh last week was the example of where it's moving. So street protests on that scale do not seem to be effective and are going to become less so. They're devising new tactics all the time. Maybe the other side needs to think about doing the same thing. Okay, nearly out of time. Yeah, one-pager. The Populist Wave, Brett Budowski. I'm a bull moose Democrat, defined by Teddy Roosevelt when he ran for president in 1912, when his platform stated this, quote, "To destroy this invisible government, to dissolve the unholy alliance between corrupt business and corrupt politics, is the first task of the statesmanship of the day." Close quote. So back in 1912, Teddy Roosevelt was fighting against corporate control and business control of government. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Back to the article. We do know this. Both parties are increasingly in disrepute with voters because neither party is listening to what voters are telling it. There's a clear electoral continuum from 2006 to 2008 that will define 2010. Parties and candidates ignore this at their peril. The continuum is a populist wave in favor of the outs and against the ins, by surges of voters who are angry or disillusioned by the status quo and voting for change. All right, well, his basic point is that the parties in power are not listening to the populists, and what he fails to recognize is they don't have to. It's a done deal. Okay, his final summation. I am a bull moose Democrat because I do believe there's an invisible government in Washington, that it's an iron chain of political and business status quo insiderism that dominates our government to the detriment of workers, consumers, and taxpayers. Washington is drowning in oceans of money and backroom deals that leave Americans out in the cold. Teddy Roosevelt would win on a landslide today, because his bull moose Americanism challenged monopolies and trust that abused capitalism, unfair practices that abused workers, lenders that practiced usury, money that corrupted our politics, greed that misused our taxpayers' money, poisons that threatened our health, and neglect that often shortchanged our troops. Roosevelt rejected a partisanship that sinks our national discourse into a snake pit of demeaning derision and disrepute towards neighbors with differing views. No. OK. Okay. Nice summation, no solution. All right. Just about out of time. Want to thank... This news flash is just in. It's from the Borowitz Report, dated New York. An important book by former Alaskan Governor Sarah Palin will be published this November, with an English translation due shortly thereafter, her publisher confirmed today. According to a spokesperson for the publisher, translators are working around the clock to translate Mrs. Palin's text into understandable English.